for being here today, and I especially want to thank Secretary Moniz for traveling to the Pacific Northwest to be part of this historic field hearing. I want to thank Seattle U and Father Sundberg, I know isn't here, for hosting us again. We were here 2 years ago now, or was that just last year? Last year, to discuss our interior issues with Senator Barrasso as it related to the fire season, and some great work came out of that hearing. So I expect the same out of this morning's discussion. So first we're going to hear from Secretary Moniz and have a chance to discuss with him for the record officially a variety of issues, mostly related to the quadrennial review and updating our energy infrastructure. And then we will hear from a group of Northwest experts on the second panel, Dr. Lynn Best, who is with Seattle City Light, Stephanie Bowman from the Port of Seattle, Mr. Robert Ezell with the Washington Department of Emergency Management, John Harrison with Bonneville Power Administration, Carl Imhoff from Pacific Northwest National Lab, and Scott Rogers with F5 Network. So I look forward to hearing all of those comments and discussions about that. I want to, again, welcome the Secretary to the Pacific Northwest and give him a great deal of thanks for coming to visit the Northwest. We're very proud of our innovation in the Northwest and the view that we have on the energy mix of our electricity grid and power sources moving forward. And he's already had a busy morning just recently visiting the Bullitt Foundation and looking at some of the smart building and zero building efforts, zero energy development that's happening in the Northwest. Later, we'll go over to the University of Washington, see more great innovation, and also over to the Tri-Cities tomorrow to look at the Hanford and Hanford issues. So it's not all the time that an energy secretary makes a two-day schedule available for a particular region of the country, but no doubt I think our region deserves to have that much attention because of the challenges and the level of innovation that's happening here. So, Mr. Secretary, before I begin my formal remarks, just thank you again for making so much time and for your great service to our country.
Thank you for hosting me.
So with that, we'll start the hearing, which, as I said, is really a hearing to talk about the critical infrastructure, updating and securing our energy resources. And the United States is in a very dramatic change and transformation of how we produce and transport energy. Many of those positive aspects, when they come from the grid or cleaner sources of energy, consumers get more efficient and low-cost alternatives to meet their energy needs. But we also know that these changes can also produce greater stresses on our transportation infrastructure, for example, like crude by rail or pipeline challenges. The energy industry and federal and state local governments must work closer together on these challenges, from updating our energy infrastructure to satisfying the demands for reliable and safe and affordable energy. As I mentioned, many of these issues are discussed in what is the quadrennial review produced by the Secretary of Energy, recently issued last year to communicate these many, many challenges. First, today we're going to talk about three of those specific challenges, those that really concern us here in the Northwest. First, we're going to discuss the pressure that increased domestic production of oil has been placing on our rail system, everything from pushing commodities off the rails to the issues of public security. The energy transformation the nation has experienced is impacting the transportation infrastructure, and we in the Northwest know how much it's impacting us. Last year, the quadrennial review concluded that increased domestic oil production had altered transportation of liquid fuels. And for us, in fact, 2010 to 2015, rail shipments to the West have increased by 10,000%. That's almost a mind-boggling statistic. For us, we went from having almost no prior train oil traffic to having almost 20 trains a week, going through every major population center, almost every major population center in our state. Cities like Vancouver, Spokane, and Seattle are very concerned about the safety of these oil trains and the high profile of incidents that have occurred across the nation, including a recent derailment that happened in Mosier, Oregon. So 26 cities in our state have already passed resolutions expressing concern or just outright opposition to oil trains. This is something even the president, when he was here recently, heard about. The second issue we want to focus on as it relates to our infrastructure, again called out in the quadrennial review, is the need to enhance and prevent cyber attacks. A successful attack on our grid, as we know in the Northwest, could have catastrophic outcomes. Outages, we know, according to the University of California, Berkeley, power disruptions have already cost our U.S. economy $96 billion annually. So today's economy, well-functioning and robust electricity grid, is very important. And as we continue to grow our energy use and energy information systems, this will become more important. The Quadrennial Review noted that in 2013, 151 different cyber incidents involving the energy sector were reported to the Department of Homeland Security. So this is an ongoing effort by the Secretary working with our national labs and Homeland Security and various industry to work on preventing further cyber attacks in the future. But I think we're here today to discuss the ideas that we should be pursuing as our information age architecture continues to grow, that our investment in cybersecurity should continue to grow. Today, almost everything and everyone relies on a well-functioning electricity grid. Our hospitals, our first responders, our water treatment facilities, fueling stations, transportation communications, everything will be impacted by a prolonged blackout. As we will hear from F5 this morning, most of our investment to date has been focused on protecting the security of our networks. Much more needs to be done to invest in the security of our software systems. Software attacks are growing. State agents acting on behalf of foreign governments or terrorist organizations have attempted almost on a daily basis to hack into our electricity grid. We've heard stories that maybe the Russians are behind the attacks on computers at the Democratic National Committee, to the fact that the North Koreans were involved or perhaps involved in the Sony system hack 2 years ago. So we need to redouble our efforts to thwart not only cyber but physical attacks against the grid as well, and to make sure we're continuing to make the investment to upgrade our infrastructure. I think the Secretary may also have some announcements about that today as it relates to Northwest companies and continuing to make that investment. But we do have many, many Northwest companies that, from big data to smart grid, are trying to help us build out the infrastructure that will keep us ahead of some of these attacks. And finally, as the climate continues to change and more attention needs to be paid to the impacts of that and natural disasters, severe weather, all of these things also impact our energy infrastructure. We know in the Pacific Northwest that 1 degree change in temperature, what that means for snow melt and what a big impact it has on our hydro system. So government has an obligation to coordinate with the private sector to reduce the impacts on our energy infrastructure. And this is one responsibility we were happy to give more direction to the Secretary of Energy in the recent passage of the transportation bill, that in case of these disasters, the Energy Secretary is in charge of a response plan as it relates to energy. So this is especially important for us in the Northwest, where we're so susceptible to earthquakes, fires, droughts, floods, and landslides, and getting that energy system up and operating again is critical. So Secretary Moniz is going to, I believe, release a report today about the Department of Energy's recent Clear Path 4 exercise. This exercise examined how well the Pacific Northwest energy sector might respond to a massive earthquake associated with a tsunami. The findings suggest that we have more to do to enhance our energy security, but clearly the federal government needs to play a role in helping us get that plan into action. So we are sitting in the middle of the Cascadia subduction zone, which can produce very strong earthquakes and corresponding tsunamis. And an event of this magnitude could wipe out the infrastructure that brings electricity and fuel for a very long time. The Department of Energy findings from its Clear Path 4 exercise are particularly illuminating. One, we need to help the energy sector assess the damage from natural disasters more quickly and more accurately to facilitate the restoration of service. The Pacific Northwest Lab is developing technology on this that will help expedite those assessments. And the federal government needs to help to use its resources to enhance the effectiveness of state and local industry efforts to restore the energy infrastructure. We all know what happens when we have a storm and the amount of time we've tried to cut down on getting electricity grids back up and operational by coordinating with utilities all throughout the region. Imagine this on a much grander scale. Third, the Department of Defense and other agencies can provide aviation and maritime resources to transport and replace equipment such as electric transformers in hard-hit areas not able to be reached by road, and can help us making sure that we have enhanced infrastructure and coordination for the restoration of those energy sector areas. So I look forward to hearing more about this report and having the discussions with the Secretary. I will just say this hearing is not we're going to explore today with our local witnesses as well and the Secretary some ideas, but we are already working on some of these things in Congress. We just recently passed out of the Senate a comprehensive energy bill, the first one in 9 years, and this bill is now in conference. It includes important provisions for doubling our efforts on research for the grid and specifically targeting cyber attacks. So it would fund modernization to make the grid more flexible in the cases of emergency. And it also, as I said, puts the Energy Secretary in charge of developing and implementing a response for energy emergencies. So I'm so pleased that that he's here today to discuss that. And we are also in the bill making sure that we continue to focus on the upgrading of our energy infrastructure as it relates to the grid and a workforce that it will take to accomplish that. So with all of that, I again want to welcome the Energy Secretary for being here today, for our great appreciation for coming to the Northwest and looking at all the innovation that the Northwest has to offer, everything from smart buildings, which we just toured, which again is part of the energy bill to upgrade that smart building efforts through the Department of Energy's help and hopefully reduce the amount of energy used, which is about 40% of our consumption is right now in smart buildings. So, Mr. Secretary, again, thank you for being in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, our hearing process is usually 5 minutes even for a secretary, but today we're waiving that. We're in the Northwest. We're going to make our own rules. Please use whatever time you would like this morning to make your testimony and discussion of any issues you think are relevant to today's subject.
Well, thank you, Senator Cantwell. I really appreciate the opportunity to address the Department of Energy's responsibilities for helping the energy sector prepare for.
Might pull that a little bit closer. I probably have the same problem.
Okay. To prepare for and respond to a wide range of threats and hazards at a time, as you said, of rapidly changing energy systems, dramatically increased oil and gas production, driving exports, engaging new geographies, requiring infrastructure development. Market structures are shifting, natural gas displacing coal, dramatic renewables growth, efficiency, challenging business models. It's really one of the most dynamic times that I think we've ever seen in the energy system. And as you have said, that spills over into infrastructure challenges that we will discuss today. But I do want to take the opportunity, given the lack of a five-minute clock, to also thank you for collaboration and for your leadership in this and in other issues, and particularly single out your commitment to innovation. I think we are very well aligned on that, and also your leadership in emphasizing the regional nature of innovation and our opportunities to improve regional ecosystems here in the Northwest, but also across the country. We're going to need that to succeed in our energy and climate goals. So, again, thank you for all of that, not to mention a great time here in Seattle. So, as President Obama has pointed out, you know, energy and communication systems enable all other infrastructures to function. And, of course, communications, in turn, depends upon electricity. So if we don't protect the energy sector, where we're putting essentially every other sector in the economy in peril. When the DOE was established in 1977, the nation's energy vulnerability was perceived mainly to be the threat of physical disruption of oil supplies. Though DOE did inherit emergency authorities from precursor agencies, and I'll come back to those, the only reference to emergency response in the DOE Organization Act was direction for DOE to develop, quotes, an effective strategy for distributing and allocating fuels in periods of short supply. So a very, very narrow reference to the issues of that of those days. Now, fast forward to this century, and we face a very different set of threats to our energy systems. In response, there are now laws, actions, and presidential directives that are focused on threats such as severe weather, natural disasters, EMP, aging infrastructure, cyber, and physical threats. So it's a considerably broadened threat spectrum that we need to consider. We need to make energy infrastructure investments commensurate to the critical role of that infrastructure and to today's threat environment. In particular, the reliance of all of our critical energy infrastructures on electricity places a very high premium on a reliable, modern, and hardened electric grid resistant to the continually evolving cyber threats. And I'll come back to this later. That is why, in the second installment of the Quadrennial Energy Review that you referred to earlier, we are focusing on the electricity system end-to-end, including the entire threat surface. So that is something that I think we share an appreciation of that priority. Now, DOE does have some longstanding emergency authorities. During emergencies, the department has independent authority to order temporary electricity connections, to make exchanges of crude oil or petroleum products from our reserves, to assist entities in procuring necessary energy materials to maintain supply during an emergency, and to control nuclear materials. We also have authorities that require a presidential finding, including orders to protect or restore the reliability of critical infrastructure, sales from the petroleum reserve, allocation of energy materials in the civilian market, and allocation of natural gas and fuel switching in power plants. So those can all follow a presidential determination. And finally, DOE has a consultative role for Jones Act waivers and a concurrence role for fuel waivers during emergencies. Now, these authorities have been used many times. The department has used its independent authority to connect temporary electricity lines, for example, to restore power after hurricanes like Ike, Katrina, and Rita. After Superstorm Sandy, the department loaned 120,000 barrels from the Northwest Home Heating Oil Reserve, NEHOR, to the Department of Defense for use in emergency responder vehicles, essentially low-sulfur diesel fuel. DOE also has had legislation and directives related to new emergency response authorities. The California electricity crisis of 2000-2001 actually led to the use of multiple authorities deriving from the Federal Power Act, the Defense Production Act, and the Natural Gas Policy Act. Now, with regard to new authorities and responsibilities, the FAST Act, you referred to, the transportation bill, provides DOE with a new authority to protect critical infrastructure against cyber, EMP, geomagnetic disturbance, and physical attack threats. These authorities do not apply, however, to natural disasters other than geomagnetic storms. So while these authorities are welcome, they do create an asymmetric situation for authorities for natural disasters and malevolent attacks, even though the outcomes could be similar. The 2015 Balanced Budget Act directs DOE to establish a Strategic Petroleum Reserve Modernization Program to protect the U.S. economy from the impacts of emergency product supply disruptions, and I will return to this later. And finally, in terms of new responsibilities and authorities, President Obama has addressed these issues through Presidential Policy Directive 21, which identifies DOE as the sector-specific agency for energy infrastructure, making it the federal lead for the prioritization and coordination of activities to strengthen the security and resilience of critical energy infrastructure. The DOE also serves within the administration as the lead agency for Emergency Support Function 12, which facilitates recovery from disruptions to energy infrastructure. During a response operation, the department works with industry and federal, state, and local partners to assess disaster impacts on energy infrastructure, coordinate response to expedite restoration, and to monitor and provide situational awareness of impacts to key decision makers. The department deploys responders who work directly with affected utilities and local officials on the ground during a disaster. Our response force is entirely voluntary, and we are training right now nearly 100 members of our staff to be prepared to deploy for all hazards contingencies. Over the past 2 years, our Deputy Secretary and I have led a deliberate effort to strengthen our emergency response capabilities and our critical partnerships with the energy sector. With 90% of the nation's power infrastructure privately owned and operated, coordinating and aligning efforts between the government and the private sector is necessary to be effective in emergency response. Our challenge here is speed. If we have a government process that takes too long to share information about dynamic threats, then we're going to fail to protect our infrastructure. Our solution is to provide tools, information, and practice so that companies are aware of risks as soon as they're identified. We can bring together information across the department and across the government and then take action together. We also partner with state, local, and tribal governments. With an updated Energy Emergency Assurance Coordinators MOU that I signed early this year, DOE will enhance robust training and exercising, bringing stakeholders together to plan for shared regional hazards. And I will come back to an example of that. One of DOE's core missions, and you've said it already several times, which I appreciate, is to support innovation. And that includes innovation to help our nation's energy security. So we are growing our partnerships with academia and the private sector, and of course leveraging our 17 national laboratories in order to make our infrastructure more secure and resilient. And at this time, I will say that in this state, we have one of our premier national laboratories, Pacific Northwest, east of the Cascades. You all should take a trip over the mountains, and we will tomorrow, in fact, do that to visit that laboratory. Of course, it will require substantial additional investment over many years to expand transformational innovation that can outpace the dynamic threats that we face. And here I will say that across the board, the President's fiscal year 2017 budget proposes the first increment of energy R&D funding to meet mission innovation goals, specifically a doubling of our energy-related R&D over a five-year period. It also proposes regional innovation partnerships, and again, Senator Cantwell has been a leader in advocating for this approach, no doubt helped by the fact that she anticipates this area would have a very robust regional response, given all of the intellectual and other assets in this part of the country. This budget will provide a very strong foundation for addressing the infrastructure needs discussed here, as well, again, as the broader clean energy investments needed for our economic, environmental, and security goals. Today, we are announcing $30 million of funding. That actually may have some additional funding added to it next year, but for today, $30 million of funding for cybersecurity, including research and development, and programs to develop energy professional education in cybersecurity. Two of the awards are in Washington State. They are at the Schweitzer Engineering Company in Pullman, Washington, with a total of about $7.5 million for the company in developing its cybersecurity software product. So that's a terrific development across the board, but certainly as well here in Washington State. Now, robust exercises are also crucial to ensure industry and government are better prepared to work as a team during real-world emergencies. In April 2016, DOE-led ClearPath 4, an interagency exercise focused on testing and evaluating energy sector response plans in a scenario depicting a Cascadia subduction zone 9.0 earthquake and tsunami, the so-called really big one made famous in the New Yorker article. One outcome of that was the importance of accelerating damage assessments immediately. And as you said, PNNL, Pacific Northwest Laboratory, is right now developing imagery tools to do just that, to bring new technology to bear on making fast assessments of damage so that responders can prioritize where they have to go in order to get not only energy up, but to provide all the other services to our displaced people. ClearPath served to elevate energy sector participation in the subsequent Cascadia Rising exercise, which was government-wide in June, and that really helped the entire emergency management team to identify resource requirements for an actual disaster. Today, as you said, we are announcing, this is a summary, the ClearPath After Action Report. I want to say that this ClearPath was very important. It was the first use of our, I mentioned earlier, this Deputy Secretary and I have been reorganizing some of the response functions. That included putting together a unified command structure for emergency response. This was the first use of that command structure. To give you an idea of our complexity, it deals with operations, planning, and logistics, but with the Office of Electricity, the Emergency Response Activity in the Office of Electricity, our National Nuclear Security Administration, our Associate Undersecretary for Management Performance, who deals with physical security, our CIO, cyber activity, our intelligence activity, and our management and administration activities, which includes procurement. All of those offices, which are spread out in the department, have now we are organizing under this unified command structure that was exercised for the first time in ClearPath 4. I might add that in addition, of course, to their participation, for the first time in the ClearPath series, we held it out in the field. This was headquartered out of Portland in our Bonneville in the field, but it was regional. And, of course, that allowed us really to much more effectively bring in state and local responders into our exercise out here in the field. We also had the energy industry for the first time, not only electricity, but the oil and gas sector. We had Canada involved and, of course, multiple federal agencies. So this was a what you need to do so that we're not trying to do it for the first time in an emergency. Very effective, as I said. It highlighted the importance of immediate assessment, but it also brought to the fore other things, for example, in dealing with industry, the need for waivers. There can be antitrust issues, particularly in the oil and gas sector, if we have to be prepared in advance so that we can do those with speed. So that was really very important, and I believe we need to do much more of this in the future. Now, I'll also add that unique to DOE, we actually own critical assets in the sector that we are supporting, and particularly relevant, and again, this part of the country, our preparedness and response activities for our power marketing administrations, like Bonneville, directly overlap with what we are trying to do, of course, with the broader energy sector. So another important direction we believe that we are emphasizing over the last couple of years is to develop what we call enterprise-wide approaches. That unified command structure is an example of an enterprise-wide approach, but the idea here in general is to bring all of our resources into play, including those at our national laboratories. And two additional examples of that is we have formed an integrated joint cyber coordination center. It's a collaborative, intelligence-driven approach to cybersecurity to protect the entirety of the DOE attack surface, including PMAs. And we are working towards a consolidated emergency operations center to allow our unified command structure to operate out of a single facility. Finally, let me turn to the issue of managing our strategic energy resources, reserves. We already mentioned that the 2015 Balanced Budget Act, drawing upon a recommendation of the Quadrennial Energy Review, supports modernizing the petroleum reserve. The petroleum reserve physical assets date back many decades, need modernization, and frankly, we should also, in my view, revisit some of the operating procedures of the petroleum reserve. But the Balanced Budget Act, again, following our QER recommendation, has two phases. Life extension phase two will address unanticipated SPRO-related equipment failures that have been impacting the reserve's operational readiness capability. And second, marine terminal distribution capability enhancements will add dedicated marine terminals in each of the SPRO's three distribution systems to address the impacts of changes in the U.S. midstream oil movement that have significantly reduced the effective distribution capacity of the SPRO in an emergency. And just last Friday, again, these hearings have a way of focusing the mind, just last Friday, the department approved what's called CD0, the first stage of project management protocols, which establishes the mission need for the marine terminal distribution capability. CD0 was already passed for the modernization, the life extension phase. And we will soon submit a report to Congress on DOE's long-term strategic review of the SPRO. So in conclusion, let me say that upon my return to DOE after a 13-year absence, I was struck by the imperatives of a new and complex mission for the department. Almost nothing that I described in this testimony was present when I left the department in January 2001. But ensuring resilience, reliability, security, and emergency response with significant operational responsibilities is really a new and very important direction for the department. And again, thank you for your support. The first installment of the QER, again, addressed these issues of infrastructure, resilience, reliability, safety, and asset security. And again, many of those recommendations are in progress. Some of them require new statutory authority. We've received some statutory authority. And these will improve energy infrastructure resilience. The second installment, as I mentioned, is on the electricity system end-to-end. And these are all critical for emergency response and for meeting our climate goals. However, the fragmentation of our current emergency responsibilities and assets within the department, partly reflected in that unified command structure, does present a management challenge. And so I want to say that we continue to analyze organizational options in light of these complex, cross-cutting, and evolving requirements. The combination of increasing responsibilities and fragmented management arrangements creates some risk the department is not adequately resourced to effectively carry out its responsibilities, and that's an area where we look forward to working with this committee and with Congress as a whole to provide an appropriately resourced energy emergency response capability as an essential component of a robust energy infrastructure supporting a 21st century economy. Thank you for your graciousness in affording me the time to provide somewhat longer testimony, but it really is a broad scope of activities, and again, we look forward to solidifying this going forward with your help and the committees. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for that testimony, and thank you for your work on the four-year analysis of, the four-year plan of our energy infrastructure and where we are as a nation, and that, I think, is a very good blueprint to start our discussions as a nation of where we need to go. And I guess I'd like to unpack that a little bit with your testimony. to me, reading the report, which is voluminous and is available for people online, I think they can get access to it, or at least the key recommendations. It seems to me that, as you tried to allude in your testimony, coming back to DOE after some abstinence.
13 years.
that we have several phenomenons that are going on, but I want to make sure one is just this issue of we wanted to get off of foreign oil. We said we wanted to produce our own, and basically we had an infrastructure through the Gulf that imported that and delivered it. Now we're in a different business, and that in and of itself is causing competition on the rails, competition even between energy products. I mean, there are instances where oil is pushing off coal, and coal and oil is pushing off agricultural products, and a great deal of complexity. So that seems to me, how would you characterize that shift in demand on our infrastructure? Significant? I mean, how would you characterize for the American people how big a challenge that change in energy has meant to our infrastructure and some of these security issues?
Yes, and by the way, I'd like to once again thank you and congratulate you for reading the Quadrennial Energy Review on the floor of the Senate, which was much appreciated. The increased production of oil and natural gas in the United States has obviously been a major story in terms of our economy and also environment, in the sense that the natural gas boom in particular has led to a displacement of higher carbon coal with lower carbon natural gas, reducing our CO2 emissions. However, I mean, the big story with regard to infrastructure is not simply the scale. It's the fact that it's happening in different parts of the country. And so it has changed flows completely. I mentioned one example here already in terms of the petroleum reserve modernization. We have oil flowing in opposite directions in many of our distribution systems, which is why we need to have a distribution system made for the current realities. Another is that it used to be that oil and products flowed from the Gulf elsewhere. Now we have considerable flows to the Gulf. Third, we have still with oil, we have, in addition, as you know very, very well, flows going east and west without established pipeline infrastructures, and therefore in bringing in trains substantially. Now, it is true that oil by train has gone down very substantially nationally in this last year, but not necessarily regionally, particularly here. But the magnitude of these changes, you mentioned up to 20 trains here in the Northwest. Recently, I was visiting one of the largest refinery complex on the East Coast in Philadelphia, and the changes are clearly stress the system. On the one hand, that one refinery was receiving 4 unit trains per day of Bakken oil, and now suddenly it's dropped to 1 as they have resumed importing from Africa light oil. So it's really hard to keep up with these major changes. And of course, as you have different infrastructure, we need to build out in different ways. I didn't mention natural gas, but a similar thing there is that, all gas until a decade ago fundamentally flowed, mostly out of the Gulf and some in the West, in the Rocky, in the New Mexico, Colorado, et cetera. And now you have an incredible production out of Pennsylvania, part of West Virginia and Ohio. The infrastructure, frankly, has not yet completely caught up to that. So these are big strains on the system, and we are feeling them.
Well, I'm glad that you characterize them as big strains, because we definitely feel that way in the Northwest. And This in and of itself, I think, is a big shift. I also think that cyber is a big shift and change, too, but we'll get to that in a second. But on this issue, one of DOE's responsibilities is obviously helping us understand the properties and characteristics of some of these products. One of the things that you are working on is this issue of oil volatility. And I particularly am concerned about the level of volatility in Bakken crude, because when product was developed in the Gulf part of our country, basically that volatility didn't exist. It wasn't shipped at that level. But with the advent of Bakken crude in the upper Midwest, we are seeing the volatility of the Reed vapor pressure, the pound per inch of pressure, well over, over 13% in some instances. So can you elaborate on what DOE is doing to measure that volatility, and what should we be looking for to make sure that we have a vapor pressure that is not going to impact the level of explosions and derailments and things of that nature that we've seen in some of these other areas of our country that have already witnessed these train accidents?
Well, I certainly wish I could give you the final results of the study today, but that still is probably about a year away. Just again, to make it, I mean, you know this, just to make it clear to everyone else that the, of course, the Department of Energy does not have the, if you like, the regulatory authorities, but right at the beginning, and I think with a lot of encouragement as well from the Congress, appropriately, we were asked to partner with the Department of Transportation, and we have, to explore the science involved in the transport of oil, and frankly, it would apply as well to other, flammable liquids, because there are a lot of others that are transported as well, and to try to understand the implications of that science for further steps that the Department of Transportation, for example, might take. So the study is being carried out, is being led by Sandia National Laboratory. It is looking at the characteristics of the oil, volatility, as you say. And basically, I think it's a question of looking at this particular crude oil has a quite a bit of dissolved gases in it. So looking at that at the qualities is very important. However, it's also important to understand how and when, for example, the oil is sampled, because as you go through different processes, the characteristics can change. So that's also part of what's being looked at, and this may be able to hopefully lead to some insights into how the sampling protocols are managed, which then can impact whether further processing is required or not. North Dakota, as a state, has taken some steps in terms of processing certain of the tight oils, and so I think.
I don't think anybody in the Northwest wants to leave it up to the state of North Dakota to figure out what the standard is.
So our job is to right now is to try to do a thorough job on the science and engineering aspects. That will include going to combustion tests in this next phase at Sandia, which has, by the way, a long history of doing combustion field tests and studies, and then I'd love to be able to accelerate it, but science takes time, and it's probably going to be a year until we have the final results, and then those have to be translated at state and federal levels into further action.
Well, I noticed that one of Sandia's reports found that, quote, currently used methods for assigning crude oil classifications are often inadequate, and that there wasn't scientific agreement on these crude oils, on the gases like Bakken crude. So how do you think that during this time period of while you're doing your work, we might be able to build on that scientific consensus, that we might be able to get more discussion going about this? Because clearly I view this as a resistance by those who think they can just ship Bakken crude on the cheap to keep doing this at this level. I note that Wall Street will not finance a deal with Bakken crude at this level. They require that it has to be 9% vapor pressure. As I said, other incidents of this kind of shipment never exceeded 13%. Now we're sitting here arguing over whether that volatility matters or not. And so what can we do to get the rest of the scientific community while we're doing this review to help in the discussion so that we don't end up with your report and then we're still doing this legwork after that 12-month period of time?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the report you're referring to was the Phase 1 report from Sandia, which was basically a literature review. It was not original work, but bringing together the literature. And again, I believe the focus there was on the fact of the large amount of dissolved non-condensable gases. So that was the characteristic I think they were saying. And that's exactly what is driving now them in their actual scientific work in terms of the characterization. I just really can't give a clear answer in terms of what one might do in terms of the, you know, I mean, prior to having the results ready. I understand there's a tension between getting the science done right and doing it as fast as one can, but doing it right, and obviously the desire to take action. Clearly, it was not that long ago when the derailment in the Columbia Gorge happened, just in June, I think it was. Nationally, there's been a decrease in oil shipments by rail that has not been the case in the Northwest. And it's also the case that I think, to be fair, I think the railroads, some of the railroads for sure, have made some pretty substantial investments really over the last year. Issues you referred to earlier, in fact, about commodity competition in the railroads, I mean, that was a very stressful period in 2014, 2015, when the whole system was again taken by surprise at the rapid increase in the demand for trains for transporting oil. I think that's been somewhat sorted out in terms of the commodity issue, but your issue in terms of any intermediate regulation, I mean, the Department of Transportation clearly has taken some steps in terms of rail cars, speeds in different places and the like, and yet we still seem to have some of these derailments, presumably caused by track issues.
Well, I, we're only going to ask you to swim in your lane today, yeah, as it relates to right, helping us on the energy verification. But I will say that this issue as it relates to commodities, I don't think is over. And I do think that your work on the quadrennial review that shows mm-hmm. that this kind of that our infrastructure cannot meet this level of demand and shipment right, without pushing product right, off. Again, probably not something that DOE can solve as it relates to right, you know, these issues immediately, but this issue right, of assessing our infrastructure, assessing our needs, and as you say, can shift at any moment as well. As it relates to source. But I go right, back to what right, you commented on, that this is a pretty big shift for the United States of America. We wanted energy independence. Well, we've got it, but now we have our own safety and security issues right here in the Northwest, with you know a 10,000% increase in the amount of oil train traffic coming through here. Yeah. And so when we have a city council in Spokane mm-hmm. who's saying we're going to fine a train for coming through, period. That's their ballot measure. Mm-hmm. These are people who are the tracks go through every major. I don't know if we have that. Oh, I guess we do have that chart here. Just to just to take for a second. Okay. So it comes from the upper Midwest, but it goes through every major metropolitan. It goes through Spokane, down through the gorge, which is a very challenging scenic area, into the Columbia River. So the rescue operations there are very challenged, mm-hmm. through Clark County, Vancouver, and then up through here and all the way up to refineries. We have four refineries in the north part of our state. So it's hitting every major city on those 20 trains per week. So So it's not, I think, you know, I'm sure North Dakota producers probably think that they are, you know, going on a very remote rural area of their state across also very remote rural parts of the North United States, but that's not what happens when they get to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the Cascades.
Yes.
They have to go through every major.
Yeah.
So it becomes, as somebody said on one of my recent trips to Spokane, just about everybody in Spokane lives 2 miles, 2 blocks from the railroad tracks. I mean, that's their view of how mm-hmm. close the mm-hmm. tracks are. So this issue for us has become, you know, very front and center with every mayor, city council, community, you know, in our state as it relates to this safety and security issue. And so mm-hmm. we will
yes.
leave this to the next panel and
yep.
discuss it more with you.
If I may just add
yes.
just that the that first of all, I think it's very clear, and the president has certainly been very clear in saying that we need to invest in our infrastructure. I mean, and we need to invest in infrastructure that is reliable, safe, and resilient for the 21st century and not for the 20th century. And secondly, in terms of the movement of commodities, and again, you know this very well from the Quadrennial Energy Review, it's also issues like inland waterways where tremendous investments are needed to move commodities around this country.
Well, and I hope we can, with your work, we are separately pushing the Department of Transportation to make an interim finding about the volatility.
Mm-hmm.
We think that they should be doing something about it now, but we're also going to double our efforts working with you to make sure that we're getting as much scientific information as possible. That, as you said, the big shift means that we need to invest in infrastructure. But the big shift also means we need to stop and say, is this safe enough
mm-hmm.
for transport?
Mm-hmm.
It's the 10,000% increase is voluminous enough to the West Coast. You could have this hearing in Oregon or California. You'd have the same discussions.
Right.
You'd have the same city councils, the same people making mm-hmm. resolutions on this.
Yeah.
So I think we need to make sure that we're making it safe as well, and we'll continue to work with our other cabinet partners to make sure that we're getting that message across. And before we get the next panels up, though, I do want to talk to you about the cyber issue, this whole issue of a unified command. So, again, I don't know how you would characterize this as a shift in our nation, but, again, I would consider it a pretty big shift because now here we are, big energy source. Electrification was always important, but now it's networks and handheld devices and smart appliances and all sorts of things, all connected to a grid that, oops, now all of a sudden is a major source of attack. So when you talk about your unified command structure and the challenges of that, where would the single entity be? How do you process information on a daily basis?
Well, the unified command structure is broader than cyber. That was for the entire our entire emergency response assets, and it's not a physical location other than when there is an emergency in the emergency operations center control room that, again, we are trying to, which historically in the Department of Energy has always been run by the nuclear security people because of our longstanding need to respond to nuclear incidents.
Mm-hmm.
But we think that we need to really integrate response across our threat spectrum. That would include nuclear, but it includes energy infrastructure, cybersecurity, and the like. Now, within cybersecurity, we have now this integrated joint cybersecurity center. I may have missed the C, IJC3. That has been the point person on putting that together has been the CIO, but working with all the cyber-relevant actors. And I want to emphasize that does include the intelligence activity. But very importantly, this involves bringing in the laboratory experts, the PMA experts. So the idea is that we are saying that the cybersecurity is really an enterprise-wide problem, and we need to have them all. It's a virtual team. It's not a physical center, but it's a virtual team bringing together all the best assets to address a cyber challenge. And I think you alluded to it. The last data I saw was 2013, but over half of the cyber incidents reported were on energy infrastructure. So it's a tremendous problem that we have.
Okay.
And what we are doing is trying to bring together, again, all of our assets.
Okay.
It would be helpful to have this more unified operations center.
Because you're talking about both DOD, I'm assuming, and our other federal agencies involved in security efforts working in coordination.
And DHS, we do a lot with DHS in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, DHS has got a major role here. So we work with them.
And, again, where would you characterize this as a shift in energy policy? This electrification of our economy and the challenge of cyber.
So if we kind of change subjects, but relevant to this, if we think about our pathway towards deep decarbonization, let's say on a mid-century timescale, there are two elements that to me are kind of part of any possible solution. One is real progress on the demand side, energy efficiency. We're not going to get there without real demand side progress. But we're also not going to get there without essentially a very deep decarbonization of the electricity sector, and therefore an expansion of the electricity sector's role in other parts of the economy, like transportation, for example, because then it will be drawing upon a essentially carbon-free system. So electricity is only going to become more and more central to all of these issues. And that, of course, brings us to the whole threat spectrum, including cyber, which we know is a very, very significant issue. And frankly, as that system itself becomes more and more, I would say, technologically complex, it's going to have increasing distances, for example, to bring renewables over large distances. It's going to have distributed generation. It's going to have storage. It's going to have a whole new layer of detectors, sensors, control systems, maybe distributed decision-making to be able to balance this entire system. That's all great. It offers new services. It can support the Internet of Things with everything hooked up. But obviously, it also opens up vulnerability, especially in the cyberspace. So I think that's what we're going to have to face, and frankly, stay ahead of the attack spectrum. So it's a huge priority for us, and I think for the country.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Secretary Moniz. I think what I'm going to have you do is come up and join us, if you will, up here, and go to the second panel of witnesses. And that will also give Secretary Moniz a chance to have a little opportunity on the other side of the dais here and ask some questions of our witnesses on these subjects and maybe even get into more of a discussion on some of the challenges that we face.
Sure.
I will say as these
thank you.
We make this transition and the witnesses are here, I see General Loewenberg out in the audience. Thank you for being here. And many of others who are here today in the audience who are responsible for these kinds of shifts and changes and are doing good work in the Northwest. So thank you all for coming and talking about how we as a region are doing some of the solution services and networks that need to be done here. So I think what we're going to do, I introduced the panel before, but I think we're going to start with Mr. Azell, who is the Washington Military Department Emergency Management Division, and then go to Ms. Bowman, who is with the Port of Seattle, Mr. Harrison, who is with the Bonneville Power Administration, Scott Rogers from F5, Mr. Inhofe from the National Labs, and Lynn Bess, who is with Seattle City Light. So with that, Mr. Azell, please lead us off.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Secretary Moniz.
And you might have to pull that a little closer. These microphone systems are a little...
Yeah. For the record, my name is Robert Ezell, and I'm the Washington Military Department's Director of the Emergency Management Division. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today about two significant events that could impact our energy infrastructure. First are the impacts that could occur to Washington State in the Pacific Northwest following a magnitude 9.0 earthquake on the Cascadia subduction zone. And second, as we've already been hearing, are some potential consequences to the energy sector from a cyber event. A rupture of the Cascadia subduction zone will cause catastrophic damages all along the West Coast from British Columbia to Northern California. Damage from a CSZ rupture will greatly exceed damage from any natural disaster our nation has seen to date. Estimates are that our transportation infrastructure, communication systems, energy distribution, water, sewage, and our healthcare system will be severely compromised or inoperative. Bridges will collapse, roadways will be rendered impassable. The coast will be cut off from the I-5 corridor, and Western Washington will be cut off from Eastern Washington. We anticipate electric power failing across the region from significant impacts to both transmission and distribution systems. Restoration will be time-consuming, with urban areas being without power for weeks to months, and outlying areas potentially requiring a couple of years before power is restored. Pipelines delivering fuel, oil, and natural gas will be compromised and possibly destroyed. This means we'll be left with only the fuel on hand in vehicles or storage tanks that have not ruptured. This has immediate implications to the response to a Cascadia event, as fuel will be required for generators, response vehicles, and a host of other needs. However, the most significant effect or impact of a CSZ rupture will be to the people themselves. Depending on the time of year, we could see upwards of 10,000 fatalities from the resulting tsunami and from collapsed buildings and landslides. We estimate we will need to provide food and water to upwards of 1 million people immediately following the earthquake. That number will increase with each passing day as individual and family preparedness supplies are exhausted. We conducted a major exercise, Cascadia Rising 2016, from June 7th to June 10th of this year. We gained valuable lessons learned that will engage our preparation activities for years to come, but perhaps the most important thing we drew from the exercise was perspective. Our overarching priority immediately following a CSC event will be to provide for the life safety and life-sustaining needs of our populace. Each day that passes increases the vulnerability and the need of our residents. This puts a critical imperative on restoring our basic infrastructure, starting with transportation, communications, and electric power. But it also greatly emphasizes the need for individual and family preparedness. Electric power is the enabling component of our 21st century lives. It also has key interdependencies with other critical infrastructure industries such as water and wastewater services, natural gas supply and delivery, and telecommunications technologies of all types. Without electric power, our infrastructure cannot operate. The same goes for fuel distribution. A CSZ event will damage the major pipeline for delivery of jet fuel as well as natural gas pipelines and will, of course, disrupt transportation networks, making fuel delivery by truck to existing depots all but impossible. And without fuel, our response efforts will grind to a halt. As I've emphasized, power and fuel are key to a successful response and recovery. Therefore, their provision and restoration has to be a top priority for us all. CR 16 emphasizes the need for detailed response and continuity of operations planning. This includes all levels of government, from local through state to federal, non-governmental organizations, and private industry, so that essential services can continue to be provided in the event of a disaster. Additionally, our lifeline sectors, whether publicly or privately owned, must work toward building resiliency. A resilient infrastructure can either withstand a major disaster or can be quickly restored in days or weeks rather than months or years. We've been talking about the catastrophic and the need to develop strong plans to build resiliency into our critical infrastructure. I'd like to touch on a couple of hazards, and we've already spoken about them today, that are not perhaps of the scale of a catastrophic event, but could have severe local or widespread consequences. The first of these is the transport of crude oil by rail. We've seen graphically what can go wrong if there's an incident involving an oil train. This highlights the need for detailed planning again, at all levels of government so that communities and states are prepared to respond when an incident occurs, such as the one near the town of Mosier back in June. The need for the same level of planning also is required for cyber threats. In Washington State, we've been hard at work there as well, conducting cyber planning across the community of stakeholders. Organic within the Washington National Guard structure is a cyber protection unit whose capabilities can assess or assist with assessment and recommendations concerning industrial control systems. They have the expertise, relationships, security clearances, and the credibility to partner and collaborate with the ICS community towards cyber preparedness. Most recently in Washington State, in a proof of concept demonstration, our National Guard worked successfully with the Snohomish County Public Utilities District to assess their systems and provide them key suggestions on how they can harden their infrastructure against cyber penetration and exploitation. Madam Chair, I'd like to close by just thanking you for your tremendous support to our National Guard, particularly the attempts to stand up a schoolhouse to address some of these cyber vulnerabilities, and then, of course, your long-term support of the National Guard. This concludes my testimony, and may I answer any questions?
Thank you. Thank you. Ms. Bowman?
Good afternoon, Senator Cantwell and Secretary Moniz. My name is Stephanie Bowman, a commissioner with the Port of Seattle. Thank you for the privilege of being here this afternoon. The Port of Seattle owns and operates facilities that play a critical role in facilitating the nation's trade. Our marine cargo facilities under the management of the Northwest Seaport Alliance are the fourth largest container load center in the country. Our port literally supplies goods to businesses and homes throughout the nation. On the aviation side, Seattle-Tacoma International Airport served 42 million passengers in 2015 and is the fastest-growing large hub airport in the country. Additionally, SeaTac is the primary air cargo gateway for the Pacific Northwest, facilitating the export of high-value, time-sensitive goods to Asia. The Port of Seattle facilities serve as a lifeline to the residents of Alaska and Hawaii, and any disruption in port operations due to a natural disaster would have serious consequences for those states. Alaska is especially dependent on our infrastructure, with more than 80% of all waterborne containerized traffic that goes to Alaska moves across the terminals at the Port of Seattle. Given the critical role that the Port of Seattle plays in the regional and national economy, ensuring that our facilities are resilient in the case of a disaster is a charge that my colleagues and I on the Port Commission take very seriously. A strong federal partnership is critical, and I'm grateful for the attention that you're giving to this issue today. Port infrastructure will be essential to the regional response in the event of a large-scale emergency. SeaTac Airport is anticipated to be a hub for relief efforts, and our maritime facilities will also support the response and recovery missions, assuming that they are still operable. Disruption of flight operations at SeaTac will send a ripple effect throughout the country's air transportation system, given that our airport's role as a hub for both national and international flights, particularly our connection to Asia. Most importantly, it could cripple our collective ability to respond to disaster. I want to speak briefly about the Port of Seattle's emergency response planning. The Port of Seattle and our partners at the Port of Tacoma use nationally recognized best practices and utilize an all-hazards approach to plan for and respond to any number of different emergency scenarios. Consistent application of these practices is reinforced through our robust and systemic training and exercise program that validates our ability to meet our responsibilities to the region. In the case of earthquakes, our contingency planning is based on the risks associated with strong to major earthquakes. Our seaport facilities, as you know, Senator Cantwell, are at greater risk than the airport because they were built on liquefaction zones and are more susceptible to a tsunami. Given the strain that will be placed on the first responders in a disaster, we expect that we will need to be self-sufficient with our emergency response at the airport or seaport for at least 14 days. The airport, on the other hand, will be more likely capable of handling moderate to full disaster relief for within 24 to 72 hours. The level of operations at the airport was a focus of federal and military entities in the recent Cascadia Rising exercise that Mr. Azell just mentioned. Understandably, the magnitude of any quake will impact our ability to resume operations. A primary factor in successfully responding to an event is the effective coordination between the dozens of entities involved. That is why exercises such as Cascadia Rising are vital to enhancing the regional resilience. We are not going to be able to operate resilient airports and seaports without a strong partnership with the federal government. In addition to the critical role it will play in responding to a disaster, we are also dependent on the federal government to help fund our preparedness efforts, and I want to speak to that very briefly. We ask that funding levels for these programs be maintained and that funding be awarded directly to local jurisdictions, including ports. While there are a few federal grant programs that focus on preparedness, the Port Security Grant Program is currently the main source of federal funding for all ports for an all-hazards investments. However, many types of projects necessary to support a comprehensive preparedness effort are ineligible under the Port Security Grant Program. Given this, the federal government, we hope, should consider creating a critical infrastructure resiliency grant program and a national strategy to help funding decisions, with prioritizing the nation's gateway ports, which are at greater risk. Finally, I wanted to close, shift gears for just a moment, and close with a personal mention of my experience in Mosier, Oregon, and just let you know that I was at Mosier for the rail train derailments, and I'm happy to answer any questions. It had a pretty significant impact on my personal view in terms of both emergency preparedness, but most importantly in terms of the response. And after the panel's through, I'm happy to answer any questions about that experience. In closing, the Port of Seattle recognizes that our infrastructure impacts the national economy and has a unique role to play during a crisis. We stand ready to strengthen our partnership with the federal government, including the Department of Energy, to safeguard our critical infrastructure and protect our communities. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Harrison, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Ranking Member Cantwell, Secretary Moniz, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is John Harrison. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer with the Bonneville Power Administration. Bonneville is a federal power and marketing administration within the United States of America Department of Energy, which markets electric power from 31 federal hydroelectric projects and some non-federal projects in the Pacific Northwest. Bonneville operates and maintains an extensive high-voltage electricity transmission system that integrates with every major electric utility in the Pacific Northwest, as well as California and Canada. Bonneville plays a critical role in responding to disaster affecting the region's electricity grid. In my testimony today, I will describe how Bonneville is protecting the electricity infrastructure and how it's preparing to respond to potentially massive Cascadia subduction zone earthquake. Bonneville has hardened its electricity transmission system and is investing in seismic-related research for more than 20 years. We began assessing which areas and components of the power system and most vulnerable to significant damage from the earthquake and other natural disasters. These comprehensive assessments have informed Bonneville's multifaceted seismic mitigation strategy and has allowed it to prioritize where and when to upgrade and reinforce critical facilities and equipment. Electricity will be critical to the region's recovery in the event of a natural disaster, whether continuing to harden facilities, protecting power system equipment, or researching the latest seismic mitigation tools and technology. Bonneville takes its responsibility of shoring up its assets extremely serious. As Chief Administrative Officer, I oversee Bonneville's Office of Security and Continuity of Operations, which implements the Bonneville-wide program for physical, personnel, information, and infrastructure security, emergency management, and continuity of operations. This office ensures Bonneville is resilient and able to quickly recover from events that cause operational impacts. With that goal in mind, Bonneville recently actively participated in two emergency planning activities. In April of 2016, Bonneville participated in the previously mentioned ClearPath 4 energy-focused disaster response exercise hosted by the Department of Energy, Office of Electricity Delivery, and Energy Reliability. The exercise scenario consisted of a magnitude 9.0 earthquake and subsequent tsunami occurring along a 700-mile-long Cascadia subduction zone, causing considerable damage to Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. The exercise scenario was designed to test regional dependencies in the energy sector. The exercise was a positive step forward in developing the national energy response capability and served as an important forum for building and strengthening linkages between government and industry. The exercise also identified improvements that can be made with respect to coordination between critical components that must work together to quickly respond to a catastrophic event. Bonneville will continue to work with DOE, Office of Electricity, and its regional energy partners to address gaps that were identified by participating in this exercise. In June of 2016, Bonneville participated in the largest FEMA exercise ever conducted in the region. Building from the energy sector-specific ClearPath 4, Cascadia Horizon also simulated a 9.4 magnitude earthquake. For our part, Bonneville held a four-day exercise with its core emergency response personnel and tabletop exercises for field staff across the service territory. Bonneville tested his plan and transferred complete control of his electric grid to a site hundreds of miles from the potentially affected area. Cascadia Rising and ClearPath 4 proved to be successful exercises for Bonneville insofar as they allowed employees and work groups to practice their training and test our implementation plans. Bonneville will continue to participate in these types of emergency response exercises so we become well-practiced and operationally ready to face real-life situations. As the owner and operator of 75% of the region's high-voltage electric transmission system, Bonneville knows investments in both physical security and cybersecurity is vitally important to safely and reliably operating the electric grid in a modern world. We recently embarked on a multi-million-dollar physical security program for critical substations, concentrating on perimeter security. This effort includes upgrading fencing, lighting, intrusion detecting systems, cameras, and alarms, and has led to more comprehensive security design standards for wherever substation facilities are upgraded or new substation facilities are constructed. In the past 2 years, we've increased our staffing around cybersecurity from 12 employees to over 40 employees and implemented a 24/7 cybersecurity operations and an analysis center. Bonneville has two dedicated teams to cybersecurity. One team performs forensics and intelligence, incident response, and 24 hours a day handling of these type of issues. The other team performs offensive research and security assessments. Bonneville even conducts offensive cyber operations against our own network to test, drill, and improve our detection and response. In conclusion, our investments to make Bonneville a more resilient organization, from hardening and protecting our infrastructure to the time that we spend to take to prepare and practice how we respond to a disaster, will ultimately help us limit damages to our electric power system and help the region more quickly recover from a major disaster. Ranking Member Cantwell, Secretary Moniz, thank you for this opportunity to testify. I would happily submit my written testimony for the record and respond to any questions you may have.
Thank you. Mr. Scott, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, Senator. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Scott Rogers. I'm the Executive Vice President and General Counsel of F5 Networks, Inc. Again, I want to thank the Senator and the Secretary for giving me this opportunity to testify and provide information to this committee and be a part of this panel to discuss topics we at F5 believe are of critical importance to the safety and prosperity of our country. I would first like to give you a little background on my employer, F5 Networks. We are a worldwide leading developer and provider of software-defined application services. We are based here in Seattle with over 4,300 employees worldwide, and applications have become the gateway to critical and sensitive data and services, and our mission is to help organizations deliver the most secure, fast, and reliable applications to anyone, anywhere, at any time. Our offerings include software products for network and application security, access management, and a number of other network and application services. In conjunction with our customers and partners across a variety of fields and industries, we are closely watching the evolution of cyber threat landscape for organizations in the 21st century. As the Senator and the Secretary referred to repeatedly during their presentations, that this concept of innovation and the innovations driven here in the Northwest are creating new challenges for the energy infrastructure. Disruptive technology trends are dynamically altering the threat landscape for organizations operating in today's world. The explosion of new software applications, the emergence of cloud computing, and the Internet of Things, combined with an increasingly mobile workforce,
or leading to dissolution of the traditional security perimeter. Legacy security architectures are no longer adequate to protect against the evolving threats posed by cyber criminals, hacktivists, and state-sponsored espionage and sabotage. To borrow from a commonly used analogy, traditional security architectures were akin to building a castle and a moat to secure the king. The castle architecture relies upon utilizing traditional network firewalls and other devices on the network perimeter to monitor and block suspicious traffic at the boundary of the network. In today's world, envision the software application as a very mobile president traveling the world who needs the protection of his Secret Service bodyguards as he travels. As the network perimeter, or in this analogy, the castle walls, become more and more irrelevant, industries need to focus on protecting the software applications that drive their business and manage their critical infrastructure, as well as verifying the identities of those users who access those applications. The leading technology industry research firm Gartner estimates that 90% of security investment is targeted at securing this network perimeter, but only 28% of the attacks are focused there. Conversely, only 10% of the security investment is focused on securing the software application itself, while 72% of the attacks are from application vulnerabilities and stolen user credentials. Our U.S. energy sector is not immune to these types of evolving threats. In particular, the Internet of Things, with the inclusion of new smart meters, home power generation devices with connections back into the power grid, and the various interfaces of the SCADA networks creating a unique set of challenges. All these new smart devices are run by new and innovative software applications whose access needs to be managed and whose data needs to be protected. And where will these emerging energy applications be developed and reside as the world moves to a cloud-centric model? Again, these applications are being built and hosted outside the castle walls. All of these unsecured new devices create new threat vectors of attack that must be mitigated. In the world of our energy infrastructure, it isn't the theft of data that is the biggest threat, but disruption of service or destruction of its means of delivery. In December of last year, hackers disabled portions of Ukraine's power grid, leaving over 200,000 residents without power for several hours. In the attack on the Ukraine's power grid, the hackers used compromised user credentials to remotely log into the SCADA network that controlled the grid. In this instance, remote workers weren't required to use two-factor authentication for remote login, which allowed the attackers to hijack their credentials and gain crucial access to the systems that control the breakers for the system. The Department of Energy has taken steps to help secure our nation's energy infrastructure with the issuance of its Energy Sector Cybersecurity Framework Implementation Guidance, containing recommendations for implementation of the NIST framework for improving critical infrastructure of cybersecurity. In the ever-evolving world of technology, it is important that organizations stay vigilant to address these exponential threats presented by new technologies and to avoid complacency. A strong focus on protecting not just the networks interconnected to our infrastructure, but the software applications that operate and support that infrastructure as well as the users accessing those software applications is critical to the safety and security of our nation's energy sector. Through utilization of web application firewalls, multi-factor authentication, and identity federation for secure remote access, with consistent policy-based access controls and security data analytics on user behavior, the energy sector can evolve its security architecture to address the dissolution of the network perimeter. With that, I would like to acknowledge the committee and thank them for giving the opportunity to recognize these threats that are emerging, and note that I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have, as well as to provide any follow-up materials.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Imhoff, thank you so much for being here today. Hopefully we'll see you tomorrow as well, but thank you for being here to testify at today's hearing.
I will be there tomorrow. Thank you very much, Senator Cantwell, for the opportunity to appear. And thank you, Mr. Secretary, for joining us in the beautiful Pacific Northwest. My mission today is to discuss issues around grid resilience and emergency response, particularly as they relate to grid modernization. My name is Carl Imhoff. I lead the grid research program at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. And I also co-chair the Grid Modernization Laboratory Consortium, which is a membership of 13 national laboratories and over 100 industry and academic partners supporting DOE's Unified Grid Modernization Initiative. For more than two decades, PNNL has supported power system resilience and innovation for the state of Washington, the Pacific Northwest, and the nation. In that time, we lead and have delivered to the nation a network of 2,000 high-speed synchrophaser monitors that monitor the nation 30 samples a second, 24/7. We've also delivered innovations in distributed control and demand response that, with the promise of delivering demand at scale and providing grid services faster, greener, cheaper, and supported the nation's largest smart grid demonstration in doing so. We're delivering high-performance computing that's taking security tools from days to seconds to converge and helping the operators, such as Bonneville, monitor the system and avoid outages. And so we've had a phenomenal long record of support to the grid, and we'll continue to do so going forward. My assignment was to talk about the link between grid modernization and security and resilience, but before I do, I have to frame my two key recommendations for the session. One, important to deliver next-generation real-time tools for situational awareness, risk assessment, and grid operations that transform our nation's capacity to assess risk in real time and help mitigate outages with decision support for operators in real time. Secondly, to improve the emergency response capabilities, leveraging new data sources and new analytic tools to enhance both regional and local planning, but also then preparation for major extreme events. So let me start with the highlights of why is the grid important, what's changed in the landscape of the grid, and then comment on how can grid modernization enhance our resilience in emergency response. The future power system is facing substantially more complex conditions and risk going forward. Today we have increased storm frequency and intensity. We see increased interdependencies between grid systems and other critical infrastructures such as natural gas pipelines, communications, and emerging market models. New digital technology is transforming the availability of new consumer services at the grid edge, but it also increases the attack plane and increases the cybersecurity challenge. Overall, the grid faces increased complexity in supply, demand, and business models. And this is a grid that today is very important to our economy, but it's going to be more strategic into the future. Our current economy is increasingly digital, but the consumers are looking for more benefits from IT and intelligent devices and all at the edge. Much of the past climate research is showing that electrification is a key to going deep in terms of decarbonization. So the grid's essential today and will become increasingly more strategic in the future. So how does a modernized grid support emergency response? Let me frame three options. First, it will deliver improved grid infrastructure resilience, such as new distribution feeders that better resist natural and human threats and recover faster, reducing the fundamental need for emergency response. An example is Avistacor in Spokane, which achieved 1.5 million avoided customer outage minutes in 2013 from its smart grid investment grant effort and advanced metering and distribution automation. They also shortened average outages by 10%, experienced 21% fewer outages, and their participation in that partnership with DOE led to an accelerated full system modernization for Avista, accelerated by probably over a decade. Enhanced real-time tools and system visibility will reduce the scope of outages, shorten the time utilities need to identify the outage locations, and optimize restoration planning to get the lights back on more quickly. An example is the use of synchrophasor monitoring that would have given the Ohio operators, had they had phasor measurement units, an hour and 40-minute warning that Cleveland was pulling away from the rest of the system. The result would have been a much smaller blackout, much faster recovery, and much lower cost to the taxpayers. Upgraded planning tools will better handle the complexity of variable generation and new markets and changing business models, improving emergency response planning, especially for extreme events such as seismic and major regional weather emergencies. So, how do we achieve these recommendations I offered? Delivering real-time tools will help operators better understand risks and options to avoid outages with accuracy far beyond current practice. One promising opportunity is the delivery of near real-time risk contingency analysis. That's basically looking at the 40 to 60,000 elements and saying, if we lose certain numbers of these, what does that do to the security of our grid? Today, operators conduct power flow to identify and rank all system risks. We've accelerated this analysis with advanced computing to take the computation from days to seconds. In the case of the Western Interconnection, this method cut the computation run from 26 hours to 7 seconds. This improvement gives operators near real-time situational awareness of risks and options to mitigate outages. Experiments in P&L's control rooms that you'll see tomorrow with grid operators showed a 30% improvement in their ability to diagnose and respond to test cases of outages using these new tools. and emerging advanced and planning tools is DOE's commission tool to assess the risk of extremely rare but large cascading events and outages. We, P&L, worked with ERCOT, Siemens, and EPRI to develop an extreme event tool that transformed the utility's ability to conduct such analyses and better prepares the industry to respond to the new NERC standards in terms of extreme events. An increasingly important element of improved resilience is grid flexibility. You get flexibility in two big ways. One is energy storage and also advanced distributed controls that the Secretary mentioned earlier. Widespread deployment of energy storage for multiple grid applications requires significant reduction in the lifecycle cost of energy storage and the validation of the value for the value propositions in multiple grid applications. To reduce storage cost while improving lifecycle performance, P&L is actively engaged in research in the discovery and development of next-generation materials. And early P&L R&D advances have been licensed to several companies, including Uni Energy, which is located in Washington State and is deploying stationary flow batteries for grid-scale applications globally. Through DOE and Washington State Clean Energy Funding, we are partnered also with Avista, Snohomish, PUD, Puget Sound Energy to validate the performance and use cases for field-deployed grid storage. A second source of flexibility is advanced distributed control theory. Transactive control concepts, a blending of traditional controls and economic incentives to engage distributed resources at scale and beyond normal utility boundaries, have been demonstrated in the Pacific Northwest Smart Grid Demonstration Project and are being extended in the Clean Energy Transactive Campus Project, a partnership between DOE and the Department of Commerce. This project will help demonstrate the benefit of demand-side controls across multiple buildings and campuses that can provide load flexibility to reduce peak demand and manage renewable ramping. Turning to specific emergency response tools, P&L supports DOE's Office of Infrastructure Security and Energy Restoration by developing technologies to aid emergency response. We're launching an effort to support ICER with automated analysis of digital satellite imagery to quickly assess infrastructure damage. It's at work today in the state of Louisiana. P&L is also supporting ICER during national emergencies with real-time visualization and communication platforms in partnership with HAMR, the federal training center you'll see in Richland tomorrow. Finally, in terms of cybersecurity response, P&L developed a program that by the end of next month will provide cyber support to the utilities that generate 75% of the nation's electricity. This is a DOE-developed concept in terms of cyber risk information sharing. It's now led by NERC and industry. The sensors and concepts came from P&L, and we continue to provide analytics for that very important exercise. The next step in that journey is to find ways to engage the small and mid-sized utilities more effectively. So in conclusion, a modernized grid should substantially improve emergency response by delivering a more resilient system, providing new planning and real-time tools to better identify and mitigate outage risks. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments. Thank you for your long leadership in terms of smart grid and grid modernization. And thank you, Mr. Secretary, for delivering the first integrated grid strategy in my 30-year career in the National Labs.
Well, thank you, Mr. Imhoff. And I will note that we've had several stops on this tour already, and in each stop, the Secretary has gone out of his way to emphasize how important the Pacific Northwest Laboratory is to the country and to the region. And so I just want to thank him. Thank you for being here as a representative of that.
He wanted a raise.
Well, that's, give him one. So, Dr. Best, thank you so much. We've saved the best for last, so thank you for being
thank
here.
You. Madam Chairwoman and Secretary Moniz, I want to thank you on behalf of Seattle City Light for the opportunity to testify today before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. My name is Lynn Best, and I'm the Environmental Officer for City Light. Seattle City Light provides reliable, renewable, and environmentally responsible power to the residents of Seattle and neighboring communities. City Light has been greenhouse gas neutral since 2005, the first electric utility to achieve this distinction. My testimony today will focus on electric utility resilience in the face of climate change. I will cover City Light's recently completed climate adaptation plan, our participation in the Department of Energy's Partnership for Energy Sector Climate Resilience, and two actual events that reflect the risks identified in the plan, the Oso mudslide and the Goodell Creek fire. While City Light owns no fossil fuel resources and obtains 90% of its power from hydroelectric resources, we are affected by climate change. In 2013, as part of the resiliency strategy for our utility, City Light committed to researching the impacts of climate change on the utility and developing an adaptation plan, including actions to minimize these impacts. City Light's climate adaptation plan evaluates how City Light is at risk from climate change, the vulnerability of our operations and infrastructure to these risks, and the potential magnitude of the impacts. It then uses this information to help prioritize potential adaptation strategies. Seattle City Light is also one of 18 electric utilities in the nation participating in Department of Energy's Partnership for Energy Sector Climate Resiliency. This partnership allows utilities to exchange knowledge and best practices as well as receive recognition for their achievements. This partnership also promotes investment in technologies and practices and policies that will enable a resilient and modern energy system. City Light looks forward to our continued collaboration with DOE and other utilities as we work together in this partnership. The importance of taking action is illustrated by two recent events. On March 22, 2014, a 300-acre landslide occurred in Oso, Washington, that killed 30 people and destroyed a local community. This happened during a March that was the wettest in history. The slide, which occurred to the north of City Light's transmission line from the Skagit Hydro Project, caused minor damage to one tower and came within feet of causing significant damage to the line. The Oso slide is an example of the impacts that we are concerned about with climate change. As the frequency and intensity of heavy precipitation increases, these loose sedimentary soils are more likely to slide. If the Oso slide had happened on the south side of the valley, our transmission lines would have been destroyed for about a mile at a minimum, and potentially more. In anticipation of this becoming an increasing risk, City Light has applied twice for Federal Emergency Management Act grants to retrofit six towers in this area to limit the amount of damage that could occur from a similar or smaller side. While the proximity of Seattle City Light's transmission line constituted a significant risk to the utility, it also provided the opportunity for us to be of assistance to the community when the main arterial Washington State Route 530 between the cities of Darrington and Arlington were destroyed in the slide. A single-lane gravel access road that was our access road for our transmission line was used as a lifeline to bypass that section and reach the community of Darrington. The Goodell Creek Fire started on August 10, 2015, and spread to the woods near the Skagit Hydroelectric Project a few days later. Seattle City Light operates three dams and powerhouses at Ross, Diablo, and Gorge reservoirs in this area. These facilities produce 20% of the power consumed by our customers. The fire changed direction suddenly and burned under the lines, forcing the utility to shut down transmission lines that carry electricity from the project. Spill gates at all three dams were opened to maintain river flows to protect fish. With 15 minutes of warning, City Light needed to replace 20% of the power needed to serve our load. The inability to deliver electricity from the Skagit also cost us $100,000 per day. The company town of Diablo was evacuated quickly, and New Harlem reduced to only essential personnel. City Light firefighters worked to protect our assets, the powerhouses and residences and other structures. The total cost of the utility was estimated at $5.3 million. Wildland fire risk is one that the utility's climate scientists had identified well before the Goodell Creek fire last August. More and longer-lasting fires have been occurring on the west side of the Cascades over the past few years. City Light had already completed FireWise projects to protect buildings, and while the fire worked its way to the projects, it stopped before damaging buildings. The utility also is applying for mitigation funds from FEMA as part of the repairs following this fire to replace the timber saddles that were part of the New Harlem Creek penstock. In addition, we are training our firefighters in wildfire fighting. In addition to the physical threat, we had to move our balancing authority to our Boundary project. Unfortunately, Boundary has limited storage. It's a run-of-the-river project. And as a result, there was fear that there would not be enough water available at Boundary, and we would have to declare a capacity emergency. We were able to contact our
our fellow utilities upstream, and we want to thank Avista and Ponderay PUD for providing water to allow us to continue to keep Boundary as our balancing authority. This is an excellent example of utilities providing assistance under emergency situations. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Well, thank you, Dr. Best, and again, thanks to all the witnesses today. You obviously represent the interests of our infrastructure across a variety of different areas in your testimony and help illuminate some of the challenges that we have been dealing with here in the Northwest. So thank you for that. I think I'd like to begin with you, Mr. Ezell, as it related to some of the things that you have mentioned, you know, in regards to the National Guard. And obviously you and I have worked together on OSO and on the two major fires that we've had in our state, so we've had a lot of chance to see the operations on the ground. I guess in talking with both you on some of those events and now hearing from Commissioner Bowman, I just want to ask you on this issue of rail response, since I used to say ports are us, but I think we should say ports are us and railroads are us. If you have this many, if you're a state of our position and export opportunity, we become central for pushing product. And obviously that advent has been on crude by rail, major shift to change in what we have seen. How are you best preparing for these issues as it relates to these population centers across our state?
Madam Chair, thanks for the opportunity to comment on that. The Washington State Legislature realized the criticality of this issue, and in this biennium, they allocated funding for four FTEs to the Washington Military Department and Emergency Management Division. And our specific purpose is to work with the counties and communities along these railroads, both the incoming railroad along the Columbia Gorge, but also secondarily the outgoing routes where the empties travel, because the empties also have a hazard of themselves. And so what we are doing is working with the local emergency planning committees to build detailed response plans within the communities, within the county, so if there is an accident of the type that we saw in Mosier, that our communities are ready and able to respond.
Commissioner Bowman, did you want to add something about your experience for Mosier?
Absolutely. Thank you. So maybe to put a little bit of my remarks into context, I wasn't at the derailment, but I was there within about 3 minutes of the derailment. And so I saw the first flames go up, and I was one of the first to call 911 in response. When after the derailment and I ran down to the site, I got within about 200 yards of the derailment and the fire, which I think, as you know, Senator Cantwell, was about 300 feet from the local school. A couple of things that really stood out for me for that experience was, with all due respect to our first responders in those remote rural areas of the state — this is Oregon, but you know it's right across the river from Bingen, Washington — with all due respect to the first responders, they are all volunteer firefighters. They have no experience in dealing with oil fires, and that was immediately evident. Obviously, a fire caused by oil is much different in terms of the way you fight it than it is a fire caused by anything else. And so one of the things that the first thing that I did was call the Burlington Northern, and I wanted to call out the Burlington Northern for providing expert advice in terms of what the response would be. What I learned from the experience was that we would have foam trailers coming out to the site. Unfortunately, the foam trailers to deal with the fire didn't arrive. It was almost 4 hours before they arrived. That was probably the other big takeaway for me. I immediately called our CEO at the Port of Seattle and our CEO at the Port of Tacoma and our fire chief at the Port of Seattle and directed them to provide any and all resources to the fire that needed to be. I'm proud that the Port of Seattle provided resources to the Port of Portland, who was then able to deploy the foam trailers that arrived about 4 hours after the fire started. You may have heard later that the fire was burning so hot at that point that the foam was disintegrating before it could even get to the rail cars. So I guess the biggest takeaway from this is that, as you probably know, Senator Cantwell, it would have been a wildfire of catastrophic proportion had there been any wind that day. It was an absolute miracle that there was no wind. That's what the Columbia Gorge is known for, is wind. And there was no wind that day. There is no way that anybody could have responded quickly enough. And so the things that I would ask the committee and the federal government to consider is a few things: providing more resources in terms of training emergency responders in these rural communities. As you noted earlier, it's much different than an urban area. Having foam trailers 30 miles apart is not adequate. They can't get there in time. I would say that we need better evacuation plans. There was no plan in this community for evacuating. Literally, residents were sitting trying to figure out what to do. I was on the scene for about 2 hours. When the third car started to ignite, I decided it's time to go home and pack and find a way out of town. By then, the freeway was shut down. The only way to leave the town was through a rural gravel road that is 12 miles back into the town of Hood River. Had there been a wildfire, that route would have been closed off as well. So if we're going to have crude by rail, we need to have better emergency response.
Thank you. And what, as a Port of Seattle commissioner and mm-hmm. familiar with our waterfront access, I know we've had the mayor on some of our hearings and briefings on this. I mean, he has said he would not direct first responders to respond to an incident in the tunnel in Seattle if such an incident happened. I mean, how do you look at that same incident happening anywhere in downtown Seattle?
Well, certainly the Port of Seattle would offer, again, any and all resources. It is that my understanding is that the Seattle Fire Department should be the first responder at that point, but I don't believe that, I'm not sure that they've been trained adequately.
Do you, having witnessed that incident, mm-hmm. which I don't know exactly where to put it on a scale, but I would say it is not one of the most significant events that have happened compared to Loch McGondic, but can you imagine that not having catastrophic effects if the Mosier incident happened in Seattle? Is there a way that that event could have happened without catastrophic effects to us?
No. In the case of Mosier, it was only the fact that there was no wind that day. But in the city of Seattle, for that something like that to happen in a tunnel, I don't know how.
Or anywhere on the waterfront.
Or anywhere on the waterfront. But it is, given my experience in Mosier, it's something that the Port of Seattle is taking a much closer look at, of how we can better coordinate with the other local agencies. Because I don't think it's something that we've really adequately planned for in the past. We don't export oil at the Port of Seattle or at the Port of Tacoma, so we haven't had those immediate problems, but certainly the trains do go through the city, and we want to work with the railroads to make sure that there is adequate response.
Well, I think as an infrastructure who could be greatly impacted by that, because obviously the rail goes by your facilities, it's something that I'm glad you are looking at that. On the infrastructure on cyber, I wanted to focus on Mr. Scott. Thank you. I mean, Mr. Rogers, thank you for your testimony. When you are talking about this perimeter issue versus the software attacks, which I feel like is like an ever-changing, if somebody's going to cook up a new tool a week.
Right.
So if I get what you're saying, let's start, instead of just protecting the perimeter, let's look at the overall structure and infrastructure and ways in. How do we create, what are the steps and tools we should be taking to make this shift in policy, and what would be the three or four things we should focus on?
Well, it's interesting, and I picked up on Mr. Harrison's comments about some of the efforts that they're doing with their facilities. The implementation of their Security Operations Center, for example, using some of the advanced data analytics that are becoming common within the industry now for security purposes, to track user behavior, to determine whether or not access controls are properly being utilized, to determine
if a user is acting in a way or accessing an application they shouldn't be. I think, you know, that user access piece is one really important piece of that. Secondly, the follow-up to that was the use of these security analytics through the, you know, having a SOC, as we like to call it in the parlance of the industry, the Security Operations Center, to monitor that traffic is becoming increasingly important because you can't just have a static type of barrier to prevent attack. You need to have people monitoring and watching behavior on the network. I think actually focusing the strengths of your new perimeter around the application itself, wherever it may reside. Increasingly, it's not in your own network. It may be in a cloud somewhere. It may be in a hosted environment. It may reside on an application on a device somewhere. So the ability to protect that application through use of like a web application firewall and examining the vulnerabilities of the application itself and how you protect against manipulation of those vulnerabilities. The idea is while the moat still needs to be there for your traditional network and the wall still needs to be there, it's not enough anymore. And you really need to focus on a deeper level of security with more analytics and more proactive approach. I think in the past, one of the things that's been discussed in a risk profile, particularly here in the U.S. with the risk from terrorism, you know, there's been this concept of failure of imagination. If you can imagine the risk, then you should be able to try to find a way to defend against it. And when we run into problems is we lose that imagination about where the next attack could come from.
Well, it's certainly asymmetric. Yeah. On all fronts, and certainly when it comes to cyber, it's asymmetric. And I again want to thank our guard here, and you know the fact that we have a concentration of software, and the Air Force and National Guard, they have really taken a lead on, and the University of Washington on this issue of creating a step by step of really cyber hygiene that they believe that people should be following, as well as helping to create a workforce that is focused on getting us the best and brightest in this area. But Mr. Imhoff, what do you think about what Mr. Rogers is saying as it relates to, you know, approaching this more from a software perspective and what we need to do from the National Laboratory to help with that effort?
So I agree with him.
Okay.
There's still some work to be done on the perimeters. We learned in the smart grid investment grants that many of the small and mid-sized utilities just can make huge progress by learning basic good housekeeping in terms of maintaining your perimeter and doing training, et cetera. But we need to go beyond that. We need to deliver advanced analytics, in part related to CRISP, but that focuses on the business side of the systems. The other attack plane of interest is the control side of the grid. Part of it is design, next-generation controls that are inherently resilient and have adaptive response to threats, all hazards, not just cyber, but such that the control system helps let the system down and keeps it from propagating throughout the control system. That's part of the strategy. The other part of anticipating where we're heading, we recently helped NERC put in place their first design basis threat assessment looking at cyber, which basically says who are the actors, what are their intentions, what tools do they have? What options might they deploy to help attack? It's really getting into the analytics, figuring out where do you most need the analytics? How do you prioritize your defense inside the perimeter, if you will? And as you said, that game will never end. It'll constantly go and go and go. But that's an area where we can create more distance between us and the adversaries in terms of being more strategic and more systematic from the electric utility industry standpoint in terms of how do we anticipate and prepare the defense and the analytics.
Well, I'm going to turn it over to the Secretary, but I do want to ask, since you are looking at this from our national lab perspective, one of the things that we've discussed here locally is the notion that we need to continue to upgrade, that some of the security, as was said, is in that application, and if we can just continue to get people to upgrade, there are great securities in that. Now, of course, we're a software area, and we like upgrades. Well, let's just say we like upgrades when they work and work effectively. But, I mean, should we be looking at this in a different mindset? I mean, is this a continual game of how fast can we run ahead of the hackers? Or, you know, is there some level that we should be trying to get people to adjust to as it relates to the software side of the equation? That good hygiene is an upgrade, you know, once a year or every 2 years or something of that nature, because we are fixing so many of the identifiable problems. So any thoughts, Mr. Imhoff or Mr. Rogers, on that?
Can I go first? Go ahead.
It's a tough question. I think that the intent in the Grid Modernization Initiative is to build very strong relationships with the vendor community and try to embed best practice and more resilience to the point that Scott mentioned in the next generations of grid vendor tools that are deployed out to the systems. And I think there's a lot of room for improvement in ensuring enhanced resilience in those software systems that get deployed out into the future. One big challenge we have is in the old days, most of the grid upgrades were physical assets, and going into the future, they're going to be digital assets, very different lifetimes and the need for more frequent upgrade and transition, et cetera. So that's going to be a really different world that we face going forward. One last comment I would offer is that to unleash the innovation in this space, we need to have access to data. We need to preserve the privacy in that data. We need to preserve the security issues around that data. The department, through RPE, has been investing in several new grid programs looking at establishing data repositories that are anonymized, such that basically you remove the privacy issues in the data, but you maintain the physics that make that data useful for looking at innovations. And I think this notion of data repositories that are safe and secure, that are available to the innovation community, is a big step forward to help us unleash the innovation, but do it in a way that protects privacy and give them data sets that are safe. And I think then we can raise the bar in terms of the quality of these software upgrades, the experience of the software engineers and control engineers work at the utilities, et cetera. And you'll see that tomorrow.
Well, before Mr. Rogers replies, I would just – I know the subject can seem very dry or very geeky in some ways, but I guarantee you it's not. And when our own database in the Congress was hacked, the personnel system and the security clearance of every employee that had a security clearance was violated, you were putting the United States security at great risk. And this is – you know, going to continue, not, to say nothing of the personal side of each employee whose personal data and their own information that was put at risk, that we as a nation were undermined by those security clearances that were given to each of those individuals. That is something that a foreign agent can act on or could take advantage of. And so getting this right is very important. And while I wish the federal government was an early adopter, let's just say, Mr. Secretary, they're not an early adopter. We're kind of a late adopter when it comes to technology. So I think we're a good client, if you will, in that regard of what's happening, you know, with the large sector of our society being, you know, very late to moving forward on the latest and greatest. So, Mr. Rogers, my original question, how should we look at this? How is there a new time frame we should be looking at to stay ahead of people, just in the sense of good hygiene? Just in the sense of good hygiene.
I think that brings up a couple of points. I think there are some opportunities for good hygiene. I think, as Mr. Inhofe noted earlier, that just through their studies, they found some low-hanging fruit that some of the smaller producers and infrastructure providers could do to really help the resiliency. I think that one of the challenges that everybody faces is we have this innovation, we have these growing technologies, and it's the people to operate them. And I think one of the areas to the point of doing the upgrades, managing the infrastructure, managing the security operations centers and so forth, talent development is going to be critical as well. And I think I know that there's some efforts that have been going on that have been mentioned earlier that are very important to get the talent within the area to help run these systems. I know that, for example, an initiative that F5 did is we've reached out and have been pairing with the military for training on our products for military veterans as they leave the service. And I think it's these kind of joint public-private types of efforts that can really go a long ways towards developing the talent pool, because you can have all the software and the systems in the world, but if you don't have the people to operate them or the people to work in the security operations centers to monitor them, then you're really behind the game.
Yes, so I'll turn it over to you, Mr. Secretary. You can have as much time as you would like to ask any of the witnesses questions.
Well, first I wanted to comment on these last two comments a little bit. In terms of your question about what steps to be taken, actually, Mr. Rogers mentioned earlier in the Ukraine context, multi-factor authentication is a nominally straightforward, not always to implement, approach that can help a lot in these situations. Also, Mr. Imhoff's comment, I just want to make a comment that goes, it's much more broad than this issue. It's a common issue. It applies here, and that is as we get more and more into a world where large-scale computation, big data analytics, machine learning all become part of doing business here, the data access is over and over again a big problem. It applies as much to cancer as it does to to cybersecurity. So I think this question of data access is something that the Congress may need to kind of deal with in a very broad sense.
You mean in the repository suggestion that Mr.
For example, for the cancer issue, it's the same thing. There's a lot of data out there, but it's hard to get it. Proprietary, all kinds of issues. How it's heterogeneous in addition. So it's a big problem, broad problem, certainly applies here as well. If I have the floor, first of all, it was a terrific panel, and actually I have questions for everybody, but I will not indulge myself in that. So maybe quick questions and quick answers. I'll get three questions out. First, Mr. Zell, Cascadia Rising, your Washington National Guard, What's the first thing you think you're going to do if it actually happens? number two, let me just ask the three questions then go back. Mr. Hairston, maybe I should know this given Bonneville's relationship to the department, but what would be your assessment for Bonneville about the security and ability to respond to a problem with large power transformers? Particularly, I don't mean just one goes out, but let's say a coordinated action taken against them. And third, for Dr. Best, in your adaptation plan, I believe one of the actions put in there is so-called retreating, yes, taking facilities away from at-risk places. How big a challenge is that? I mean, are you talking about like relocating everything or just very small number of keynotes? So those are my three questions.
Well, Mr. Secretary, I'll take a stab at the first one. I mentioned that probably the key thing that we took away from Cascadia Rising, at least in the Emergency Management Division, was perspective. And it really, truly turned how we look at a catastrophic event on its head. And in terms of the first thing that we're going to do, obviously, for those of us who are in state government, I think the locals, the first thing is going to be to essentially take care of ourselves and our families. So do I have to dig out of my house? Mm-hmm. Has it collapsed on me? Will I be able to get to work to function? And so that really drove home to us the fact that we need to have extremely detailed response plans. So for every emergency support function, whether it's transportation, whether it's communications, whether it's power, all integrated, because what happens in transportation is going to affect what happens in ESF-12, it's going to affect what happens in ESF-6 and 8. And so all of our detailed planning needs to be to an extreme level of granularity. But then the big takeaway that we have is that those plans need to be run by somebody else, because a significant number of us who the state may be planning on responding are going to be victors. Mm-hmm. And so it's a case of really truly putting together that planning, have somebody else outside of our area to be able to run those initial few days of the response, mm-hmm, until those of us who are in the area can dig out and then start establishing our capability and then starting to take it back. And so hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, no, interesting. Yeah, because I figured it's chaos, basically.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
All right, Mr. Secretary, in terms of the second question, in respect to our ability to address, an attack on a number of substations and subsequently the impact on transformers, it's interesting. I think we're growing in our ability to be able to respond. I think you might be aware that industry has done a lot of coordination on looking at spare transformer parts, what we can do to maybe leverage the number of or the amount of inventory that's existing. But, you know, being able to respond or replace transformers is a difficult measure. It takes months, if not years, sometimes to get the replacement transformers. So that's why it is important for the industry to work together. The other thing is that, I mean, they're so expensive. You're not going to make that type of capital investment and have those types of, that type of inventory sitting on the bench, so to speak. So, we've got a what is called a spare transformer equipment program that's industry-wide that's, we've gotten a lot more involvement and I think positions us to be able to respond. I know there's been some thought of, strategic transformer reserve program that's been, again, part of the FAST Act that contemplates being able to respond in terms of a disruptive event. I think that would be a good complement to the existing program, so that's something that I think is worth definitely exploring for the industry.
Mm-hmm. Good. We'll have a report on that. You're probably working on it. Some people from BPA, at least, are working on it for Congress this year.
Yes.
Okay. Retreating. So, I want to point out that retreating was the fourth of four different strategies that we put forward. And we also said it was a strategy sort of last resort because of this, of the consequences of it. Mostly what we've looked
at. That's why I asked about it.
Yeah. So we've looked at hardening of infrastructure like we are looking at in the OSO-type landslide situation. We're looking at increasing resilience like fire-wise for our facilities. But we looked at retreating where you have a facility that is in, say, a floodplain that you know is going to be repeatedly at risk. And luckily for Seattle right now, it doesn't look as if Seattle City Light has critical infrastructure in the areas that are going to be flooded in the city. And so we're looking at the, what I would say, lesser infrastructure in those areas. But I think also this is a reason why it's so important to work on climate preparation now, because the decisions utilities are making now will last for 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50 years. And if we make the right decisions now, we can greatly reduce the impacts on our customers, on the utility, and also on the environment. And so I would say that one of the reasons for highlighting that in the plan is to say, we really don't want to be put in the position of having to move massive, infrastructure or, desert it and recreate it somewhere else. So I think that's one of the reasons that to be aware that you can't harden everything necessarily, and you want to be careful about where you put things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just add to that, Dr. Best, and I know we're going to wrap up here, but the if your other utility associates were here today, they would be singing the same song as it relates to our wildfires and the amount of transmission that burned up and the costs that are now left with utilities to try to replace that in many parts of our state. I mean, millions of dollars of infrastructure in an afternoon just gone. So figuring this out, really, really important for us. Yeah. Well, I just want to thank the panelists and again, the secretary for your testimony. You've given us some good ideas to think about. I guess as a summation point from my side, I definitely am hearing and sensing both from you, Mr. Secretary, but from our witnesses, that we both are making preparatory plans and we're both thinking of these challenges, but we need to somehow marry them together. The state and local and Fed need to figure out how we continue to have this discussion and marry our solutions so we can give the American people our best efforts on these challenging new energy problems. And I just thank everybody for being here today to give us that insight. And again, you've been traveling to the Northwest. Again, this subject is probably something people would like to put off to another day, but the realities of it are that they're affecting us right now. And so I thank you for your willingness to come here and do that. And I don't know if you have any concluding remarks you would like to make.
No, just to thank you for the hearing and thank the witnesses because there's some very interesting information there.
Great.
We'll follow
thank
up.
You all very much. We're
thank
adjourned.
You. I have a,
I know.
It's your phone call. It